This is Audible.
Whole Story Quest Audiobooks presents Just Off for a Walk by Stephen Reynolds. Narrated by Jeff Cummings. Acknowledgements. In no particular order. All those who took the trouble to come out and visit me on the trip. Tasha, my folks and stepfolks and Tiny. Mickey B and Haley, Sophie and Dan and Ezra. Lou, Paddy. Friends and family who stayed in contact throughout, including Bruv and Tom, and my lovely grandparents, all the people I met along the way that helped make this trip so wonderful. Special thanks to Ted, Malky and Haley for helping to proofread this document. Disclaimer. This book was written using notes made during the walk and from memory. It's therefore possible that I've got a few things muddled, chronologically speaking. A certain cove or cliff appearing in the wrong order, that sort of thing. As you will realise soon enough, I also have no idea what I'm talking about regards species identification, both animal and plant, so I've probably got some of that wrong as well. In summary, if you read the book accepting that your narrator is an idiot that doesn't know what he's talking about, you'll be fine. Prologue. Daylight at last begins to creep under the curtains, and I watch motionless as the digital clock display on my phone flicks silently to 6 o'clock a.m. I haul my sorry carcass from beneath the sheets and leave Tasha snoring contentedly as I amble to the bathroom. I catch sight of myself in the mirror and would register alarm if I could summon the energy to do so. The bags under my bloodshot eyes sag in shadow, and my skin resembles the grey of a short-dated steak on the shelf of a budget supermarket. It's now 12 nights since my brain forgot how to sleep. The frustration and panic of the first 5 restless nights have long since been replaced by a resigned, zombie-like numbness. I think back over the last 8 hours. I must have drifted in and out for short periods, surely. I cannot say with any certainty what first set in motion this wretched set of circumstances. I had occasionally, I assume like most people, had sleepless nights over the years, but nothing of this nature. Whatever the root cause, it had ceased to matter at some point during the 3rd night. The thing had its own legs now. I was not sleeping because I was worried about not sleeping, which was worrying. A never-ending cycle of deafening silences and high-speed stillness. As I sit and sip at a strong coffee, even our pet house rabbit Bovril is giving me a wide berth. His usually expressionless deadpan face eyes me with suspicion from afar, as if inquiring, "What is with you?" It's Saturday. At least I don't have the prospect of another unproductive workday ahead of me, trying to hide from view my all-too-obvious exhaustion. I make a snap decision to go for a walk in the countryside. Maybe some fresh air in the August sunshine will be of some help. 8 months later. And so, the day has finally arrived. Friday, the 1st of April, 2016. The day I start my adventure. 630 miles. A guidebook, well, 4 of them actually. A pack that's at least 800 times heavier than it should be, and a rummy feeling in my gut that mixes excitement and foreboding in equal measure. The sabbatical from work sorted, finances accumulated, and the 3 months spent fielding the same 3 questions. Why? Is it for charity? And how many of you are going? Finally behind me, the answers being, it's complicated. No, and just me. It's not complicated, really. In short, so as not to bore you this early on in the proceedings, plenty of time for that later, that walk I went on in the August sunshine ended up changing everything. I discovered by accident that a long walk is far and away the best medicine for insomnia. Cleaning out the old noggin and injecting a slice of much-needed physical exertion into my otherwise sloth-like existence. Gradually, over the subsequent weeks and months, I became an enthusiastic long-distance solitary walker, a hobby that at any time in my life up to that point would have appealed to me slightly less than being captured by Somali pirates. A 37-year-old office worker who enjoys a tipple and exercises marginally less than the average cheese sandwich. Yet here I was, spending my precious weekends exploring the countryside for hours on end, on my Todd, and loving every minute of it. My sleeping had not returned to what you might class as normality, but had improved greatly and reached a level at which I was able to function, and I always slept soundly after a day's walking. So addicted did I become to this blissful, self-imposed isolation that one-day walks were soon not enough, and I yearned for the freedom of the long-distance trail. The idea was born. The Southwest Coast Path is the big daddy of national trails in the UK, over 600 miles in length, and including some of the toughest terrain these shores have to offer. A challenge that many attempt and fail, and that many more take years to complete. So the obvious choice for a pasty podge face pushing 40 with orienteering skills equal to any cast member of The Only Way is Essex. Note, this journal is pretty much a dead cert to be an international bestseller, read all over the world. So please feel free to insert your own culture's equivalent reference to a reality television show charting the lives of the abominably stupid. Likewise, if you're reading this in 100 years' time or in another galaxy. The path starts in Minehead, a Somerset town that is neither the prettiest nor ugliest that I'll encounter on this trip. Along the promenade stands a statue that marks the starting point, a giant pair of cast-iron hands holding a map and standing about 12 feet high. My other half, Tasha, and I had driven to the start point early on the morning of the 1st. It takes a very special kind of life partner to agree to be without their dearest love for 8 weeks, to stand by and watch as the object of their affections walks off alone into the sunset, like some brave and handsome explorer, perhaps Indiana Jones. So it's with the deepest admiration and pride that I report to you, dear reader, that Tasha stood strong throughout, somehow holding back her tears. She rallied bravely with jokes about being glad to get rid of me and driving me to Minehead to make sure I'd actually left, that kind of thing. A real trooper. In addition to Tasha, there would be other humans, and the aforementioned rabbit, who would miss me and doubtless yearn for me to return and continue to enrich their otherwise meaningless lives. My family and friends, who had all promised, the latter largely with drunken sincerity in the pub, that they would definitely come and visit me and walk a stretch of the path with me. So I'm absolutely certain this will happen. Worthy of special mention are my parents. My dad, Pops, because he has always loved exploring the countryside and would dearly wish to be taking this journey with me, meaning he would be both a valuable source of advice and an enthusiastic supporter. And my mum, because in taking this trip I've condemned her to 8 weeks of sleepless worry, certain that she is at any moment, day or night, about to receive the news that I've fallen down a mineshaft or been murdered by a psychotic Cornish fisherman with a grudge. After posing by the statue for the obligatory photographs and musing for the first time that, blimey, this pack is quite heavy, Tasha and I walk along the pavement and eventually into some woodland. After 30 minutes or so, and an emotional goodbye, she turns back, and for the first time I'm alone. Curiously, Tasha has chosen to retreat at the exact moment we arrive at the bottom of the first steep hill. So my first 20 minutes alone aren't spent staring in awe at the beauty of my new surroundings or reflecting on how the dream is finally a reality, but rather climbing, red-faced and panting, up a zigzagging woodland hillside. When I reach the top, I sling off my pack, collapse onto the floor and reach for my water bottle. Half a mile done, only 629.5 to go. Chapter 1. Somerset and North Devon. Exmoor, introducing Rowley and Queen Victoria Toby Jugs. The remaining 9 mile walk to Porlock Weir, once I emerge from the woodland path, is more moorland than coastline. For the most part, I'm separated from the sea by several vast wind-swept Exmoor hills. It somehow has the feel of a first day, a warm-up for what is to come, a dipping of the toe. The sun is shining through the gaps in the clouds, and there is a strengthening wind as I excitedly stroll onward. The path follows wide farm tracks between fields inhabited with dozing cattle and grazing sheep. As I pass one group of cows, I'm sure I hear one say, "Hey, girls, get a load of this guy. Look at the size of his backpack. He's not going to get very far. Good luck, Podgy," another one shouts as I march past. The path remains flat and easygoing over the next few miles before I clamber down a steep, slippery valley between two hillsides. The view opens up, and I experience the vastness of the sea for the first time. The horizon where water meets skyline, which I'll doubtless become accustomed to over the coming weeks, for now arrests my progress. Wide-eyed and open-mouthed, I stare, dumbfounded at the scene. It's then that I have my first encounter with the wild Exmoor ponies that adorn the North Devon countryside. I spy a group of four trotting enthusiastically at pace towards me. I tell myself there's nothing to worry about as they loom ever closer. Just being friendly, I'm sure. Merely curious blighters, I'd expect. They come to an abrupt standstill a few feet in front of my petrified frame, wearing expectant expressions. After standing very still, avoiding eye contact with the equine natives for a few minutes, maybe seconds, their interest seems to wane, and they eventually begin to unenthusiastically graze on the short hillside grass. Clearly I've disappointed them in some way, as I assume they were expecting some kind of edible reward for their attentions. Feeling slightly rejected and not very much like a brave explorer, I begin very slowly to edge past them. My heart is still pounding, and when they are just out of view, I too break into a brief, albeit fractionally less coordinated, trot. Almost immediately thereafter, the attractive harbour-side settlement of Porlock Weir comes into view in the distance. For the second time today, I'm stopped in my tracks by the breathtaking views of the endless ocean. A short while later, during the long descent toward the weir, I pass an eerie area of bare, lifeless treetops protruding from the sand, known locally as the Dead Forest, before a final and somewhat ungraceful haul across a pebbled beach to end the day's walk. My final destination is a room above a restaurant bar that completely blows my daily budget out of the window before I've even got going. I'm due to meet Pops and my stepmum Jane here later in the evening, when they'll treat me to a very welcome hot meal. Even though it has only been a few hours since I said goodbye to Tasha, I'm looking forward to seeing them both and telling them all about my first day. They live on Exmoor, so I'm hopeful of enjoying their company a few more times during the next week or so of the trip. The gent at reception is positively thrilled to see a muddy and dishevelled individual with a comically oversized backpack trudging sweatily through his foyer. He duly proceeds with haste to show me to my room, with an expression that whispers tactfully, "Please leave the public area immediately, sir." My room, like the rest of the establishment, is a Hogwarts of Victorian Gothic meets Christmas. Presumably peculiar to my room, though, is an extensive, to the point of unnerving, collection of royal-themed trinkets, from Charles and Diana commemorative dining plates to Queen Victoria Toby jugs. Even an Andrew and Fergie shot glass, all staring down at me from every corner of the room as I peel off my clothes and collapse onto the creaking four-poster. The evening with Pops and Jane is an enjoyable one, spent marvelling at the eccentric decor, scoffing down several elaborately prepared courses and knocking back a few nightcaps. Eventually, after arranging to meet up again a bit further down the trail and saying our goodbyes, I retire to my room. I turn off the lights so that the former kings, queens, princes and princesses of England can't see me, and take a moment to collect my thoughts. A wave of tipsy excitement washes over me. This is real now. I'm up and running, and for the next couple of months it's just me and the path, plus an oversized, overweight backpack. Day two begins in the April sunshine with a steady ascent through farmland that's littered with exciting, leaping lambs and their weary mothers. As I pass through the Countess Lovelace's arches, not as exciting as it may sound, I open my guidebook and glance at the map charting today's 13-mile trek to Lynmouth. The four volumes that make up the official National Trail guidebook for the South West Coast Path are exceptionally well written and informative. Each of the four authors does a sterling job of guiding the walker through this mammoth journey. I feel I should get this truth out there from the get-go, as I may spend much of my time over the next 8 weeks swearing at them and wishing a plague upon their households. So, as and when I recount such moments, please know, with complete clarity, that it's I who am the incompetent party. Rowley, my collective name for my guidebooks, a shortened version of one of the author's first names, is never wrong. A few hours into a long stretch of dense woodland, Rowley advises me that I'm about to see England's smallest church appear below me through the trees. As I stare down at it from the hillside, I scoff and say out loud, "You've got that wrong, Rowley, old boy. I've seen many a smaller church than this one in my time. Call yourself a guide, sloppy." Needless to say, Culbone Church is, of course, the smallest in the country. As I continue through the woodland strewn with stunning waterfalls, more akin to a tropical rainforest, I come to the first, but certainly not the last, path diversion due to erosion or landslips. I start to see glimpses through the tall overhanging trees of the glimmering sea with views across to Wales. The woods are dense and dark, and I've not met a single person on the path all day. It strikes me that less hardy souls than myself may by this point be allowing their minds to wander to countless horror movies set in deep dark woods, not dissimilar to these. Not I, however, dear reader. For some reason I have always felt safe, confident and at home in the woods, even as a child. Just as I think this, a man, naked save for a pair of stag antlers sellotaped to his head and a long beard made of moss, appears. He beckons me with blood-stained hands to his cave for sweets and cuddles. Note, that didn't happen. When I do eventually meet the first fellow walker of the day, a friendly middle-aged man with eyeglasses so thick that his pupils are magnified to alien-like proportions, we exchange pleasantries and swap a few stories. He has been walking the coast path most weekends for longer than I've been alive, and as his massive eyes glance over my sweaty red face and oversized backpack, a silent judgment is passed, as if to say, "Good luck, Treacle, you're going to need it." He then mentions, with some apparent amusement, the Heartland to Bude stretch of the path that's coming up in a week or so. "I've done it once, never again," he chuckles. My spirits undampened, I continue along the undulating woodland path. There are continued fleeting glimpses of North Devon's dramatic coastline, revealing the scale and challenge of the path sprawling out before me and off into infinity. Eventually, after several vicious ascents and descents, I arrive, exhausted and aching, at the attractive village of Lynmouth. I buy myself a double cone, Mr. Whippy, with flakes, and climb an unjustly steep hill alongside a road to reach my campsite for the night. I set up my tent in a picturesque spot under an oak tree by a flowing river. This successfully ensures I need the loo every 20 minutes throughout the night. The next morning, after I experience a considerably less comfortable rest than the previous night, Pops and his faithful sheepdog Tiny meet me at the campsite bright and early to accompany me on the first half of the day's 14-mile walk to Combe Martin. Our bellies, full of bacon butties and pedigree chum, respectively, we set off in good spirits. The full majesty of the North Devon coast presents itself to us as the path finally leaves the woodlands behind for the time being. The drama is incredible as we enter the Valley of the Rocks, with winds pushing us onward and pinning us back. The path zigzags through the jagged landscape as families of mountain goats breeze up and down the impossibly steep hillsides with languid ease. Tiny eyes them suspiciously, thinking, "Funny-looking sheep. Wonder what they taste like." Eventually, I manage to moan about the weight of my backpack to a volume and frequency that causes Pop's resolve to break, and he finally offers to carry my tent for me. After numerous climbs and further majestic views, we arrive at the foreboding Heddon's Mouth. We descend the vast, steep hillside down to sea level and walk half a mile inland to the Hunter's Inn pub. Here we meet Jane for a drink, after which Pops and Tiny will depart with her. Well rested and alone once more, my first task is to ascend the other side of Heddon's Mouth. The climb is back-breakingly tough. The weight of my pack causes me to struggle to keep my balance as I sweat and puff my way up the meandering path. At the top, fuzzy with exhaustion, I pull myself along the cliffside towards the sea and turn the corner. Here I get the payoff for my heroic climb. I've arrived at an area known as Peter's Rock. I'm startled by the wall of silence that engulfs me. The inward half-moon shape of the rocky landscape some 400 feet up creates a whimsical and slightly surreal scene. As my heart rate slows, the angry wind and wild lapping of the sea is replaced by a still serenity, and it feels as though I've discovered a secret haven, as though I'm the first person to ever set foot on this turf. I decide there can be no better place to stop for lunch. As part of my meticulous planning for the trip, I'd researched what food supplies I would need with painstaking precision. I subsequently disregarded these findings, however, and plumped instead for a diet exclusively made up of salami, Mars bars, and individually wrapped mini-cheeses. I'm confident that a consistent mixture of protein and sugar will see me through. After devouring my taste-the-difference saucition, sweaty cheese and nougat-based confectionery, I reluctantly tear myself away from the wonder of Peter's Rock to face the elements once more. The stunning views continue as I scale the mighty Trentishoe Cliff, where I meet a couple out for a day's hike with their ludicrously excited Golden Labrador. We chat for a few minutes, and they are duly impressed to hear about my 630-mile quest. In fact, so complimentary are they towards my efforts that when I continue on my way, I'm internally composing an award acceptance speech, possibly for the greatest achievement in the history of mankind award that I'm sure to win upon crossing the finish line, just after being showered in ticker tape by an adoring crowd. I'd like to thank my mum and dad for bringing me into this world and teaching me to believe that dreams can come true if I work hard enough. Tasha for being the wind beneath my wings. My sixth form history teacher, Mr. Turner, for... I stop in my tracks. There is a public footpath sign ahead of me, but no southwest coast path option on it. No reassuring acorn symbol, the waymarker for all national trails in the UK. It dawns on me that the sea is much further away from me than at any other point of today's walk. How long have I been accepting my greatest achievement in the history of mankind award for, without paying attention to where I was going? 20 or 30 minutes? As I spend the next half hour retracing my steps to eventually find and rejoin the coast path and the turning I missed, I take the opportunity to compose an award acceptance speech for the Moron of the Year award that I'm sure to receive in the unlikely event that I ever make it home. I think back to all the conversations I'd had before I left with friends and family, where I quipped, "It's not like I can get lost. I mean, if the sea's on my right-hand side, I'm going the right way." How we laughed. A while later, Rowley advises me that I'm approaching the highest point of the entire southwest coast path, the dramatically titled Hangman's Hill. It's the second severe and ultimately painful climb of the day. I'm tired and a smidge grumpy as I snail up towards the summit. By the time I reach the top, I'm an ungainly, panting mess. But it doesn't matter. The payoff is spectacular. A wave of euphoria washes over me as I experience the sensation of feeling like I'm on top of the whole world. As I stand triumphantly astride the cairn, I'm almost moved to tears with the sheer exhilaration of it all. The Herculean sea stretches out in front of me, and a strong wind revitalizes my weary spirit. What's more, it's then that I get sight of my final destination for the day as Combe Martin comes into view in the distance. After spending a few more minutes gazing out to sea and catching my breath on Hangman's, the tiredness begins to kick in again, and the long, slow descent into Combe Martin drains the last drops of energy from my aching limbs. I have not organised a place to stay for the night, and so, when I finally arrive at the main street that runs through the village, I begin to look around for a B&B. After being mercilessly turned away at three separate doorsteps, I eventually find a vacancy at a small guest house at the end of the road. The two chaps that own and run the establishment are friendly and welcoming to a fault. They usher me in, make me a coffee, and we chat about my journey. They advise me that I've just missed a girl who stayed with them, who is also walking the entire path on her own. They also note that my backpack is clearly too heavy and that in a few days I've got the Heartland Key to Bude stretch coming up. Rather you than me, best of luck! A few hours later, having scoffed down a sub-par burger at a local pub, I'm lying in bed listening to an audiobook. I have filled my phone and iPod with a collection of stories and music for the trip. Musically, I'm accompanied on this epic voyage by the complete works of Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine, the greatest band in the history of music, fact. The complete works of Jim Bob, the singer from the Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine's solo moniker, and a selection of tracks from various other artists, all noticeably pre-millennial. In terms of literary works, I have a large number of P.G. Wodehouse, a selection of crime fiction, and all available audiobooks by the author J.B. Morrison, a.k.a. Jim Bob, the singer of the greatest band in the musical history, Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine. I'm currently listening to Coffin Road by the excellent Peter May. As I lay in the dark, listening to the narrator traversing the book's themes of memory and sleeplessness, I wonder what part, if any, my insomnia will play on this trip. The next thing I'm aware of is the sound of my alarm going off 7 hours later. Sandy beaches, pancakes, and weird feet. The start of the fourth day is a comparatively flat one, with some unpleasant road walking thrown in for good measure. As I begin to get close to the town of Ilfracombe, my darkening mood is realised by a road sign in the distance, which reads, "Welcome to Hell." I approach it somewhat apprehensively to discover it actually reads, "Welcome to Heel Bay," but has been tampered with and partially obscured by the overgrown roadside flora. I consider who may have altered the sign and their motives for doing so. It seems a pleasant, sleepy cove, distinctly removed from traditional visions of eternal damnation. I conclude the most probable explanation is bored youths, for whom the day-to-day reality behind descriptions such as pleasant and sleepy would constitute a hellishness of sorts. I climb up the hill, leading out of Heel Bay, and into a rabbit warren of footpaths set amongst overgrown woodland. The waymarkers disappear, and I'm left to rely on my natural sense of direction if I'm to avoid ending my days on a hillside just outside hell. I revise my opinion regards the identity of the road sign vandal, and imagine now a desperate and disgruntled rambler altering the place name with the intention of warning fellow walkers against entering this forsaken spot. I'll probably discover their decomposing remains at any moment. After a frankly embarrassing amount of time wandering aimlessly, I finally pass a clearing in the trees, and am greeted by a view of Ilfracombe down below. With a sense of relief, I begin the descent into the attractive seaside resort. It's impossible to even begin any description of Ilfracombe without talking about Verity. Verity is a 67-foot-high steel and bronze statue that stands at the entrance to the harbour and totally dominates the scene. Created by the artist Damien Hirst, Verity is a heavily pregnant woman wielding a sword and scales of justice whilst standing on top of a collection of law books. One side of her naked body has the skin removed to reveal a fetus curled up inside her. Needless to say, she has received a somewhat mixed response from the inhabitants of this small North Devon harbour town. Personally, I love her, even regardless of her artistic worth, with themes of truth and justice like a modern realist statue of liberty. I think she's beautiful. But then I don't have to live with her. If you live in Ilfracombe and don't like Verity, it's kind of impossible to avoid her. Having rested at the feet of the controversial young lady to consume my meat, cheese and chocolate-based daily rations, I'm now weaving my way through the streets of Ilfracombe and up the hill on the other side. The sun is now shining brightly, and as the path gets more interesting and challenging, the views in either direction are stunning. I stop and chat to a chap who I'll call Tony. Tony isn't actually his name, but he looks like a Tony. Tony is wearing camouflage trousers and some sort of military survival sleeveless jacket with at least 900 pockets in the front. Every pocket appears to be full. With what, I don't ask. He can only be about 40, and if I had to guess, I would say his attire is not representative of his profession in any factual sense. Despite a slightly intimidating first appearance, Tony seems to be a lovely guy who holidays in Ilfracombe every year to walk nearby sections of the coast path. This is his first year doing so without his beloved dog, who, he tells me, sadly passed away a few months ago. After a few minutes, we part ways and wish each other well. A minute or so down the path, I turn round to look at the view and see Tony standing watching me in the spot where I left him, staring intently at me with arms folded and a stony straight face. I decide he's probably just soaking up the view as well, so I give him a little wave and keep going. After another minute, I glance behind me a second time and Tony is still there, arms folded, legs apart, watching me as I walk away. I move on swiftly and don't turn round at any point during the next half hour. My feet are starting to scream at me by the time I reach the beautiful Lee Bay. The weight of my pack, as well as giving me an increasingly unpleasant rash on my shoulders, is causing the pressure points on my feet to start hurting the last few miles of each day. I'm confident my feet will man up over time, and after consulting Rowley, I see that the day after tomorrow's walk is nearly all on the flat tarmac as I make my way around the first estuary of the trip. This news buoys my spirits as I assume it will be practically like a day off, no hills and a chance for the feet to recover. I spend a short while in Lee Bay watching the sea lapping at the rocky shoreline as noisy gulls swoop from cliff to cliff. Then there is a steep climb out of the bay along the roadside, followed by a short stretch containing many steeper, stepped climbs that leave me utterly exhausted by the time I reach the cheerfully named Mort Point. Mort Point, like Hangman's Hill the previous day, is an important landmark early on in this journey. It's the point at which I turn the first major corner. I'm no longer looking out across the Bristol Channel to Wales. Although I won't be officially looking at the Atlantic Ocean for a few days yet, it feels like a big moment, and I get my first proper sight of Lundy Island. It's also a notorious spot historically for shipwrecks, hence the name, and will have been the last sight witnessed by numerous unlucky folk in years gone by. I consider the possibility of it being the last sight I witness, as I'm unsure if my feet can take me any further. It's then that I catch sight of my destination for the day, Woolacombe. The sight causes me to double-take, as no sooner have I turned the corner at Mort Point, when the rocky, rugged cliffs are replaced by a vast yellow sandy beach. Littered with hundreds of surfers, the scene is surreal, almost absurd. The sun is beating down on the sparkling blue sea, and I wonder how I've gone from North Devon in April to the California sunshine in the space of 5 minutes. Woolacombe is a small surfer village full of trendy surf and turf restaurants and bars, as well as various surf-related shops. After wandering around, taking it all in for a while, I stop at one of the bars, order an ale with a plate of fish and chips, and sit contentedly, looking out across the beach. I end up remaining in this picturesque spot for the evening, and watch a beautiful sunset with a warm, tipsy glow. The next morning, I'm sat in an American diner, eating pancakes, swimming in maple syrup for breakfast. The walls are adorned with pictures of Betty Boop, James Dean, Mickey Mouse and Marilyn Monroe. A vintage jukebox is pumping out Beach Boys tunes and an old 1950s surfing video is playing on a TV screen in the corner. To say that the owners of the B&B I stayed at last night are proud of their novelty retro diner would be something of an understatement. As they bop from table to table, pouring out fresh coffee, the whole scene has the feel of a long-running Las Vegas show, where the performance is played out each and every morning of the year, each time with the same enthusiasm and excitement. It's impossible not to enjoy it. After the heaviest breakfast in living memory, I saunter down to the beach to begin the 15-mile trek to Braunton. I meet Pops, Jane and Tiny on the beach for what will probably be the last time of the journey. I've been walking further away from their homestead for a few days now, and after today will be out of range. They'll walk the first hour along the sands with me before heading back. We discuss all the adventures that still lie ahead of me as the bright sun warms the sand beneath our feet and scores of surfers appear from VW camper vans in every imaginable colour scheme to take up residence among the lapping waves once more. When the time comes for them to turn back, I feel a pang of loneliness with the realisation that I'm now on my own for real. I have no doubt there will be a few other visits from friends and family during the course of the journey, but for a while at least it's just me, Rowley, and the endless ocean. I push on to Baggy Point, where I catch sight of a buzzard for the first time. I stand, watching as the graceful and majestic bird glides overhead, surveying the land beneath it, with views of Lundy Island ever present in the background. Soon after this, I cross my second beach of the day at Croyde, and by the time I reach the third of the day at Saunton Sands, the novelty of walking on loose sand in heavy boots whilst lugging the cursed backpack has all but evaporated. To compound matters further, I must then cross a golf course. Whilst I would not yet call myself an experienced long-distance walker, I have trod the trail for long enough to have developed a potent loathing for the sport of golf and all who partake of it. Although you might not know it, golfers and walkers are, to my mind, natural enemies. They may move amongst each other in polite society as if given the chance they would not inject each other with a deadly killer virus or set fire to each other's eyeballs. But this is merely a mask worn by way of concession, so as not to bring about the end of the civilised world. Out here on the battlefield, away from the muggles, anything goes. The walker's argument is thus. I'm out here, in the rugged, isolated beauty of nature. I'm miles from anywhere, and in a state of bliss only understood by the fellow cagouled rambler of the species. And then, bang, some jive turkey plonks a giant golf course where my path should be. The wonder of nature is replaced by manicured lawns, gravel tracks and signs, warning me of the dangers I'm about to face by having the temerity to enter here. Then when I try and negotiate my way through this prissy wasteland, I'm met by the tuts of the Argyle Sweater Brigade, who look at me as though I'm Stig of the Dump dirtying up their precious course. As for the golfer's argument, well, who cares? They are evil people, and I will not indulge their irrational views. True to form, I'm lost shortly after entering the course. Rowley is as much help as a guide dog's cataract, and I'm eventually shown the way back to the path by a passive-aggressive American lady, aged somewhere between 300 and 400 years old, with leather skin and a luminous pink baseball cap. I've clearly interrupted her game, and her assistance is fuelled by a desire to be rid of me rather than by any semblance of kindness. After calming the nerves, I reach Braunton Burrows Nature Reserve. The Burrows is of historical significance, primarily because it was used during the Second World War as a training ground for Normandy landings. It's also of ecological importance, as it's the largest area of sand dunes in the country. I cannot lie to you, however, none of these points of interest are at the forefront of my mind as I slump onwards in the afternoon sunshine. My feet have given up the ghost entirely. Every step is fresh agony, and the pack on my back now feels like a giant sack of spanners. I stop and peel off the boots and socks for a moment to let my feet take a breather. I'm struck by their resemblance to skinless raw chicken. After a sustained period of feeling sorry for myself, I clamber to my feet and hobble onwards. A bounding, wiry man of pensionable age sidles up beside me in sandals and shorts, carrying a well-used and noticeably small rucksack. I won't repeat in full our ensuing conversation, but in summary, I'm advised, I'm carrying too much stuff. I look terrible and exhausted. I'm not going to fare well on the Hartland to Bude stretch, and that I ought to be aiming for closer to 20 miles a day if I'm really wanting to complete the entire coast path. After delivering this motivational speech, he strides off into the distance. For the first time, I think I can see things from the golfer's perspective. Sometime later, I arrive, emotionally and physically deflated, in Braunton. I haven't booked anywhere to sleep, and so I knock on the doors of each of the village's three B&Bs. I'm turned away by each one. I wander back down the path out of Braunton to see if I can spot any potential places to pitch the tent, but I'm really in the wrong place to try out wild camping for the first time. The walk into Braunton is along the River Cane and offers no obvious camping options. Likewise, in the other direction out of Braunton, where Rowley advises me that the path continues along the riverside to the estuary that makes up tomorrow's walk. Thankfully, I'm too tired to panic or even muster annoyance, and so after some deliberation, I decide on the course of action I must take. I'll get a bus to nearby Barnstaple, stay the night in a hotel, which I should be able to manage without booking ahead in a town of that size, and then catch the bus back here tomorrow morning to then walk back to Barnstaple as part of tomorrow's leg. A winning end to a winning day. On the bus journey over, I get talking to a nice chap who is on his way to Switzerland on holiday. He advises me which hotels I should try when I get to Barnstaple, and even recommends a pub for dinner. This conversation perks me up a bit, and when I arrive in Barnstaple, after wishing him well on his travels, I book into the nearest available hotel. I dump my stuff and head straight for the aforementioned pub, where I eat chips and drink beer until they eventually ask me to leave. Boring estuaries, non-existent castles, and Hartland to Bude. After arriving back in Braunton and rejoining the path the next day, I'm feeling confident about the walk ahead. Since having my pride dented slightly by old wiry sandal man back at Braunton Burrows, I've decided to take advantage of the flat, easy walk around the estuary and make up some time by extending the distance for the day to 23 miles. It's a bold move, given the state of my feet, but I figure it's mainly tarmac and gravel paths, so how hard can it be? A few hours later, I'm sat huddled under a tree in the pouring rain at Fremington, staring down at my angry purple feet and silently cursing my own stupidity. The rain has been constant and driving all day, and I'm nowhere near half distance yet. Having negotiated Barnstaple and many a busy road to get to this point, I'm thoroughly fed up of flat tarmac paths already. I soldier on, soaked to the bone and muttering crazed exclamations of discomfort with every step. When I arrive at the bridge that crosses the estuary at Biddeford some time later, I decide to stop in a pub for a late lunch. I sit with my feet elevated, pointing at a roaring open fire, nursing an ale and nibbling tentatively at the sorriest-looking cheese sandwich I've ever seen. I consider phoning my mum and crying at her, but ultimately decide this wouldn't be a very becoming move for a 37-year-old Indiana Jones-type brave explorer. I pass through Biddeford and the picturesque village of Appledore with its narrow, cobbled streets and colourful terraced cottages. Eventually I reach Northern Burrows, from where Rowley advises me it's a gentle stroll to my final destination for the day, the brilliantly named Westward Ho. I'm still feeling sorry for myself as I begin the long walk across the burrows, and the mushy purple splats where my feet used to be are still causing me much discomfort. I distract myself by in turns cursing Rowley's chipper optimism and contemplating how other place names would sound with the addition of an exclamation mark. Bognor Regis, Swindon, Bath Spa. I can just see Westward Ho in the far distance when the driving rain turns into a full-scale hailstorm. A major feature of Northern Burrows is that it's a wide-open expanse. No trees, no shelter. I stand, defeated, drenched, feet throbbing, weighed down by my backpack as thousands of miniature balls of ice pelt me from every angle at breakneck speed. It's a low point. Later that evening, having booked a room above a pub along the Westward Ho seafront and taken a long, hot bath, I wander out to stare at the sea. It's angry. The waves violently crash against and topple over the promenade wall as the wind howls and the rain falls once more. It's breathtakingly beautiful, and the rigmarole of the day is instantly forgotten. It's stiff upper lip time. I'm on a journey, and the journey must go on. The flat, dull paths of the estuary are behind me, and tomorrow's hike to Clovelly promises a triumphant return to form. After an inexplicably early start due to an untimely sleepless night, which I've chosen to ignore, my spirits are sky high midway through the next morning. I'm walking an undulating hillside path in a blustery wind, way above the still raging waves. Dramatic, far-reaching views and a sense of total isolation leave me almost euphoric in light of the last 24 hours. I take a detour down onto the beach and the sea, suddenly conscious that I've barely touched the surface of my constant companion over the last week. I strip my wounded feet bare and tentatively dip my toes in the ice-cold, angry ocean. I enjoy a brief second before the cold truly penetrates, where I imagine that there is a bond between the sea and I, an understanding, a connection that renders the icy water warm and pleasant against my skin, something truly unique and spiritual. I then spend the next 5 minutes doing Frankie Howard impressions, ooh-erring all over the shop as the cold mercilessly floods my insides. "Up yours, the sea!" I cry as I clumsily leap from rock to rock back to my abandoned boots and socks. I climb back up to the path and consult with Rowley. He advises me that I'll shortly be passing Peppercombe Castle. I stride on enthusiastically, looking all about me for the aforementioned monument as I go. An hour later, I finally conclude that Peppercombe Castle does not exist. Rowley has cracked. The isolation of the long-distance trek has left his anthropomorphized pages in a state of terminal gobbledygook, poor fellow. Thank goodness he has a sane companion to look after him. I stop for lunch at Buck Mills and make an important culinary decision. It's time to let the individually wrapped mini-cheeses go. Big words, I know, but hear me out. They are sweaty. Increasingly so. As I walk gallantly onwards through this breathtaking coastline, I do so amidst a potent cloud of smelly cheese. No more. If cured meat products and nougat-based confectionery items aren't all I need to see me through the next 500-plus miles, then I simply don't know what I'm talking about. No more than an hour into the afternoon, and the walking is still excellent. I'm seeing enticing glimpses of the beautiful Clovelly getting ever closer through the trees as the path becomes shrouded in woodland once more. I'm slowing down, however, as, right on schedule, my feet are starting to throb. I'm hobbling at less than a mile an hour as I reach the start of Hobby Drive, a broad track that will lead me into Clovelly. The woodland becomes thick and dense for the final few miles of the day's walk. It strikes me, not for the first time on this trip, how much rubbish there is strewn about me. I cannot fathom the mindset of people that would bring a packed lunch out to the middle of the countryside and then just leave all their crap behind. Beer cans, fag butts, crisp packets and cola bottles littering the beautiful wilderness. It just doesn't make sense to me. Either you're the type of person that drops litter and doesn't care about anything other than yourself, or you're the type of person who goes for a long walk in the countryside. Can anyone be both? That's what is most distressing about it all, I think. I become increasingly angry the more I notice and am muttering profanities under my breath. I won't repeat them, as if you are reading this. There is, I estimate, a 1 in 5 chance that you are my grandmother. Hi, Grandma. And I will not swear in front of my grandmother for someone as worthless as a litterbug. As I arrive in Clovelly, the isolation of the walk is replaced by a coachload of tourists. Here to marvel at the undoubted beauty of this tiny, unspoiled village sticking out into the sea. The village is essentially one very steep, cobbled street running down to a small harbour. The street is adorned on either side by picture postcard cottages with crooked beams and hobbit front doors. As I wade through the small crowd to the pub where I'm staying, I'm thankful not to be here a month later in full summer season. I find my way to the pub and am greeted by the landlady who shows me to my room. She is a friendly woman whose voice rasps with the memory of 1,000 cigarettes. As has become customary, I've booked the cheapest room available, with shared bathroom and single bed. However, the landlady advises that I've been upgraded for free, as there is nobody else booked in tonight, and I now have a double bed with ensuite. Result. Later that evening, I'm sitting in the pub with a plate of chips and a pint. I phone Tasha, my folks and my brother Mark, and look over my notes for the first week. It dawns on me that I've now walked 100 miles. A milestone moment only slightly tainted by the thought of another 530 miles carrying that backpack and listening to my screaming feet. After a decent night's sleep, I'm chomping on some Weetabix when an idea hits me. I remember having a tube of ibuprofen gel in the darkest recesses of my pack. I finish my breakfast and return to my room to pack up before setting off for the day. I find the tube of gel and proceed to cover my feet in it. I generously rub on about 4 layers, then decide I may as well use the entire tube. It's slightly past its use-by date, but I assume this is to be of no concern. I don the kit and say my thank yous to the ashen landlady as I pass her wheezing on a gasper by the pub's front door. I'm about halfway back up the hill out of Clovelly when my error of judgment becomes apparent. My feet have gone completely numb. I also simultaneously lose some degree of spatial awareness as the lack of any sensation other than a faint tingling in my feet leaves me unable to judge where the ground is. I resemble an astronaut walking on the surface of the moon as I attempt to carry on up the hill. When I reach the top, I waste most of the day's water supply washing my feet. Initially, this makes little difference, but the feeling eventually begins to return as I ludicrously push on, feeling like Mr. Soft from the Soft Mince TV ad. After a long stretch of ancient woodland, I reach open farmland and a clifftop path. Here I meet the saddest horse in the world. He ambles over to me and walks, stony-faced, alongside me for some distance. I don't have the vocabulary required to describe to you how sad this horse looks, so you'll need to take my word for it. At the next stile, we say an emotional goodbye, and I leave him with some words of much-needed encouragement. I can only hope he takes them on board and turns his life around. The sun is out, and the temperature warm, but the sea is still anything but calm below me. The going is getting tougher as the day wears on, with increasingly steep descents down to sea level and ascents back up to the cliff edge again. My pack is weighing heavy on my back, although, and I only dare whisper it, I do sense a toughening up in that regard. I think I'm slowly starting to get used to the weight. The same can't be said for my feet, however, and the gel having now completely worn off, they are aching to buggery once again by the time I stop for lunch. As I'm chowing down on the old salami and Mars combo, the second bright idea of the day, vis-à-vis the much aforementioned feet, occurs. Socks. I have 3 pairs of extra-thick walking socks with me. Why am I only wearing one of them at a time? A more pessimistic fellow than yours truly may allow himself to dwell on how blindingly obvious this potential solution seems. An even more down-in-the-mouth chap might border on despair that it had taken him this long, and an entire tube of expired ibuprofen gel to grasp it. Not I. It's with mounting excitement that I set off after lunch, adorned in additional socks. The difference is positive and immediate, though by no means total. The cushioning of the pressure points turns down the pain a couple of notches. Enough, though, to understand that padding is the answer. Huzzah! The remaining miles to Heartland are eventful. Firstly, I stumble upon a valley full of bluebells, the first I've seen this year. As well as being a beautiful sight to behold, this gives me an amazing sense of progression. I'll watch the seasons change during this walk. The very tail end of winter was still in evidence on the high, desolate cliff tops of Exmoor. Spring is now in the air, and I may even see the first signs of summer before I reach Poole Harbour. This could turn out to be wishful thinking, but it's pleasant nonetheless to be reminded of the enormity of walking 630 miles in one go. I then come across a military radar, a giant futuristic mushroom perched on a clifftop, completely at odds with the natural beauty surrounding it. It seems I'm being regularly reminded of this coastline's important military connections. Historically interesting, but thus far visually depressive. Everything gets a bit Tolkien as I near Hartland Quay. Jagged rocks protrude from the rich green landscape as the sea reaches fever pitch hundreds of feet below. My hotel for the evening is the only building in view for miles around, perched right out among the raging waves. Hartland is the point where the Atlantic Ocean officially meets the Bristol Channel, and this makes for all-year-round stormy drama. My room, which I've again acquired on the cheap as the hotel's boiler is down, has a huge bay window facing the sea. After dining in the excellent pub attached to the hotel, and having a drink with a father and son in the bar who are walking a 3-day stretch of the coast path, I retire to my room, move an armchair in front of the window, and sit and watch the oceans endlessly collide until it's too dark to do so. My heart is full. Behold, the day is upon us, Hartland to Bude. A growing sense of foreboding engulfs me over my Weetabix as I think back on all the warnings I've received regards today's 15-mile hike into Bude and the county of Cornwall. I peruse a leaflet on local walks, picked up in the hotel foyer as I sit at the breakfast table. For the walk along the coast to Bude, it says, not for the faint-hearted, and advises 8 to 9 hours walking time. Gulp. Rowley describes the day's trek as severe, and advises me I'll pass no towns or villages until Bude. Gulp. I feel as though I'm heading off into battle. Due to the lack of shops, I've not been able to acquire any padding for the feet, and so I've gone the whole hog and I'm wearing all 3 pairs of walking socks. I cannot move my toes, but this feels like a 3-socker of a day. Feeling as ready as I'll ever be, I head off with the waves still crashing below. After an initial climb out of the quay, the path is winding but not immensely difficult. Then I hit an area called Speke's Mill Mouth, and the day really gets going. A steep climb and descent, then immediate climb up again, sets the tone for the rest of the day. Not only in terms of difficulty, though, as what all those folks who warned me about today didn't think to mention is how utterly spectacular this walk is. Speke's Mill gives me the first of the day's amazing views, as well as a pair of stunning waterfalls. Further steep climbs and descents at Swansford Hill and Welcome Mouth offer similar challenge and similar reward. They are interspersed with cliff-edge stretches and a number of small diversions due to erosion. Eventually, already exhausted, I come across a tiny hut, positioned on a hillside, in total isolation. Rowley duly advises that this is the bolt hole of one Ronald Duncan, a playwright and poet who used the hut as a means of escape and inspiration to get the creative juices flowing. A little tentatively, I open the door and venture inside. There are a small table and chair in an otherwise bare room, save for examples of Duncan's works adorning the walls. On the table is a large bottle of water as well as a pen and an open book. A note says I'm welcome to take a drink and write something in the book before I leave. I do both, and then take 5 minutes to read some of the comments left by other walkers over the months and years. All previous comments are emotional outpourings at the sheer beauty of this place and of the writer's works. This makes me feel guilty, and I cross out my joke complaining at the lack of parking and toilet facilities and replace it with an acceptable platitude. Another steep descent awaits immediately upon leaving the hut. This one is Marshland's Mouth, and at the footbridge that crosses a stream at the bottom, I pass a wooden sign that says Curnow, Cornwall. North Devon is behind me. North Cornwall awaits. Under different circumstances, this may be an emotional moment for me, but I'm knackered, and all too aware of what still awaits me, so I plough onwards. Yet more steep climbs at Littermouth, Cornicky Cliff, Yolmouth, and the back-breaking Henner Cliff follow. The views back into North Devon are simply breathtaking. I stop for a late lunch at the top of Henner Cliff, where I meet the father and son that I'd had a drink with the previous night. I'm ashamed to say I'm slightly pleased to note that they are also panting, red-faced and sweaty. We chat for a few minutes. They took a taxi out to Bude this morning and are walking back.